Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It is Thomas Trantz here. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. I want to look back at the whole season a little bit here. But first, so we did the Game 7 hero draft yesterday, right? And yep. Then the game was like perfectly scripted, so there couldn't be a true hero. You know what I mean? Like one team never leads. The eventual game-winning goal is the 3-0 goal scored in the second period.
By
Ryan Nugent-Hopkins.
Who
I drafted.
Correct.
So, but like...
Also had Evan Bouchard.
I also had Evan Bouchard.
You did not have Cody Ceci.
No, but...
But neither did I.
So I think the only two...
I think you won.
I think the only two viable options are Bouchard or Hopkins.
Yeah, 100%.
Or Nugent-Hopkins, but like... It's a modest victory. Like, no, you know what I mean? It's not like, oh, they're going to build a statue of RNH after that one in Edmonton. It's like, yeah, no, you got
I got Zach Hyman. He scored.
Yeah.
I got Connor Garland. He scored. No one had Philip Peronik or Cody Ceci.
Nope. So I guess I'll take the win. But yeah, there was like, that was a low hero relevance game, game seven for the NHL, for sure. Okay.
Well, it was just such a weird flow to the game.
Yeah.
And that's why I kind of like, analytically, I don't think you look at it and read too much into it, right? I talk a lot about truth serum in the playoffs, right? Like the way we analyze a team, right? Mm-hmm. The process with which I try to analyze a team is not about March, right? It's about what will matter when the season's on the line, when you're stressed out, when you have an emotional blow, like a loss to a player in a key moment. Like, what can you fall back on? What is your true talent level, that line that exists as like a true north in evaluating a team, but also is extremely hard to decipher, and results sort of go up and down all around it, without it necessarily being easy to pick out, right? And for me anyway, that's why when I think about this series in totality, it's like the Canucks had all these misses. Right, they kept missing the net. That was sort of where Rick Tocchet was prepared to concede about the offensive mm-hmm. play of his team. Yeah, we missed the net too much. 37% of their shot attempts got on net 5-on-5 in the playoffs. You know, they were closer to 46.5% in the regular season. I mean, that's a huge difference. This team took a lot of shots from the perimeter, a lot of shots from the point. They were really reliant on playing to the outside, right? Outside in to generate their offense. Everyone blocks shots in the playoffs, right? Like, I do think it's fair to say that approach came up against its limit. Like, that approach was exposed to be something that the club's going to need to find, like, an additional gear offensively to make sure that the next time they bump into McDavid and Draisaitl, mm-hmm. you know, they haven't brought a knife to a gunfight, right? That I think, is absolutely a fair takeaway coming out of the series. And it's not necessarily how game seven went. It's that across the whole series, the Oilers had 22 additional inner slot shots. It's that the Canucks got outscored 8-3 in the two decisive games at the pointy end of the series after taking the lead 3-2. It's that they only scored 2.5 goals per game in the playoffs. There's no team in the conference finals. Like, there's only one team below three, and it's the Dallas Stars at 2.9. You know, like, There's another level to hit here in terms of this team's ability to generate offense. Did you hear Chris Knobloch's post game? Did you listen to
Knobloch?
I didn't,
actually.
He was sort of asked about the Canucks, and he, you know, really lathered some praise on Rick Tocchet, but he framed it in such a unique and telling way, in my opinion. I was really impressed with Knobloch over the course of the series, by the way. We can get into that a little bit more. He was talking about the buy-in of the group. And then he sort of said the quiet part out loud and said, I think the way that Rick talked, he didn't say his name, the way he's managed to sort of disguise the flaws in that lineup and get the most out of all his players, right? Now, usually you hear the way he got the most out of, disguise the flaws, mm-hmm. even hinting at that is like pretty unique, but I think it's super evident. If you've really spent a lot of time watching video on how the Canucks play and you're as smart a hockey guy as Knobloch, coming away with that takeaway to me is phenomenally interesting, phenomenally telling. And I think matches a lot of what we've been talking about with like the thoughtful way that this club has approached winning games. Right?
Well, and I think, so if we're talking about the lack of scoring in the playoffs, right, which is obviously a very fair talking point. It's what bit them in Game 7. And it's easy to, like, use Game 7 as a write-off, a one-off. But when the problem in Game 7 was also the problem that was dogging them throughout the playoffs, right, like, that's obviously something that's going to be a front-burner issue. So we've talked about that generally, but then the natural kind of question that comes up is, well, what specifically contributed to that, right? And I know, looking at the inbox during the game last night and during the flow of the game, a lot of frustration with the players missing the net, a lot of frustration with maybe some of the coaching, the game plan. And so you start to kind of break down and try to divvy up blame or responsibility. Like, why weren't they able to generate more chances? And I do think, you know, to Knobloch's point, Rick Tocchet was working with what he had to work with, right? And can you criticize, you know, Ilya Mikheyev getting that shot alongside JT Miller and Elias Pettersson to start the game? Yeah, you absolutely can. But it's not as if there was a wildly obvious high upside option just sitting there waiting to be used either, right? Like, Rick Tocchet,
sorry, you're talking Game 7 lineup?
Yeah, Game 7 specifically.
It felt a little Galaxy brain, though. I do think that's fair.
I know, and my point is Rick Tocchet is not infallible. Like, he's not above reproach here, but you also can't say, like, oh, Rick Tocchet didn't find the answers. You have to acknowledge the limitations, right, of the personnel group as well.
And he didn't, I think it's fair to say that he didn't find the answers. I just don't think it's fair to say he didn't find the answers and not add the context that he was not exactly playing with a full deck.
Yeah.
And you know, the Besser injury, I think, just from a hockey perspective, beyond the emotional blow, like, if you're a team that already has Pugh Suter on its top line, right, that already has Dakota Joshua, and you know how highly I think of Joshua, but you already have Dakota Joshua in your top
playing
six.
Playing top 6 minutes.
Right? And you already have Pettersson playing significant heaps of time with the likes of Lafferty and Mikheyev. Well, when you then lose your, you know, most bona fide top line winger, right, that's not a blow you can take. That becomes like a punch to a glass jaw, as opposed to a punch you can take and keep going. So I think that's part of it. But, you know, in Game 6, I think Knobloch made two changes that didn't, like, change the series, but just, like, effectively narrowed the gap between a Canucks strength and something that the Oilers had struggled with. Carrick coming into the lineup just helped them in the draw, right? The Canucks were winning too many faceoffs. Canucks won a lot of faceoffs last night, too, as the Oilers kept getting kicked out. I don't know what they were doing to bug the linesman, but there was something in there.
Who knows what goes through a linesman's head in the faceoff circle?
Sorry, I'm going to annoy everyone. I'm trying to say more lines people. Anyway.
Okay.
Anyway. Sorry, you're going to have to help me here. I'm so tired.
Carrick coming in, winning
Carrick,
faceoffs.
And then the Ryan, Fogel, McLeod third line, which just gave, like, the Canucks had more forward speed than Edmonton. That's one of the big personnel changes that really worked for this team this year. They actually were fast up front, faster than most of their opponents. That really helped with, like, the neutral zone wedge, the back pressure they were able to exert, the way they were able to force turnovers on the forecheck. Like, Vancouver's overall arsonist game plan was so well served by their forward speed, and Edmonton struggled to break out against it in moments in the series, and when they did, the Canucks control play. Obviously, it didn't happen frequently enough because the Canucks didn't control play on balance.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment they put Ryan Fogel and McLeod together, removing Corey Perry from the top nine, team speed's a fragile thing. All of a sudden, you had three lines that could really keep up, right? You had three burner forward lines, and none of Vancouver's forechecking pressure worked consistently the rest of the series. It was like just one extra line that could move. They weren't a huge threat. They didn't outscore the Canucks in their minutes. It didn't change too much. It just avoided Edmonton getting bogged down. And that was all it took to flip this series at 5-on-5. That was the move in Game 6. We never really got to see Tocchet answer it because of the Besser injury.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're fighting fires. I would say, you know, I don't really understand. I feel like he was just trying to win a game 2-1, right? So you put Lindholm with Garland and Joshua because it's been productive, ignoring the fact that they haven't generated anything. Like, no zone time.
But to be fair to talk it, putting Bluger back there didn't work either in terms of running.
No, it didn't.
Driving play.
No, it didn't. But
that would be the other logical option with those two guys.
For sure. But you had options at your disposal that worked and that we never saw again. Pettersson, Hoglander, Garland was a combo we saw and then never saw again. Miller between Garland and Joshua worked.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, you could have gone Miller between Garland and Joshua and left that Hoglander, Lindholm, Pettersson line that actually looked pretty good in game 5 and 6 together.
Yep.
As opposed to having Mikheyev up with Miller and Pettersson, which was never going to score. You know, it wasn't inevitable that Mikheyev would miss wide on that glorious breakaway chance caused by a forecheck, but we all kind of knew. So I'm just saying, I think the far fairer criticism, and it's a minor one, is I think Tockett's responsibilities are probably too significant for him to have full-time responsibility for the power play while also mentoring the Twins who run PP2. But, man, he did a great job. And I do think focusing on, like, coaching is to miss.
Well, yeah, because we're talking about the Game 7 lineup decisions, right? But it's not as if the lack of offense was a Game 7 phenomenon. You know what I mean?
No, it
was on all playoffs, and even you could go back to the regular season phenomenon.
My reaction to line rushes was, like, I don't know about this.
Yeah, and that's totally fair.
Yeah.
His back was up against the wall in a big way, but again, 100%. He's not infallible. He's not beyond criticism. But I think I wouldn't look at the lack of offense from a season-wide or playoff-wide perspective as being primarily Rick Tockett's fault.
No.
Are there tactical things they can do differently? Can they turn the dial a little bit away from point shots and deflections to more dangerous types of offense? Yeah, I absolutely think they can.
See, I don't think they should, though, if they
unless they change the personnel.
If they don't add a significant heaping of speed to the back end outside of the Hughes-Hronek pair, right? Like, I think the way that they made perimeter shots such a key part of their identity was effectively to avoid giving up the sorts of rush chances that killed Bruce Boudreau and that killed Travis Green, right? Like, every other coach that the Canucks have had has been like, oh man, with this defensive group, we keep giving up rush chances. Playing this predictable, manage the puck style, relying on the forecheck, like, this is the answer, and it's the smartest one we've yet seen to the how do you defend and attack at the same time question that we've had for the last 5 years around this group. And, you know, obviously if you can get a couple significant, like, two-way upgrades, especially skating upgrades for your bottom four, not easy to do, we can have a different conversation. But I think the way Tockett approached that made a ton of sense. Honestly, you just need more creative players in the lineup, and that's why management tried to get them, right? Like, that was a priority for them. It's just ultimately they decided not to go as all in as, you know, as getting Gensel and Toffoli might have required.
Yeah, and I think getting the players that will allow them to play a different system. I still think can you not in the playoffs, right? But, like, because then I think it's too late to go away from your system and to start asking the guys to do different things. You have to stick with what's made you successful. But even if they have similar personnel coming back next year, can you try to build in a little tweaks? I'm not saying, like, revolutionize it, go away from what they were doing to limit those rush chances against, but just look for a little bit more of those dangerous offensive chances. But I do agree that the key is find the players that will allow Rick Tockett the freedom to do that, that will give him the confidence to build more of that in. And then I think a power play coach as well, like, just has to be part of the summer for the team, a dedicated power play coach.
I just think once you get to the playoffs, it's so hard to generate offense that you at least have to be trying to generate off the rush. Mm-hmm. You have to be trying to generate off the rush and down low. And, you know, the second stick stuff that the Canucks were trying this that they were really reliant on, like, man, when it works, when you're getting the bounces, it's one thing, but when it doesn't, it looks like you're doing nothing, right? And that's just too often how it felt as Vancouver's season was decided in game 6 and 7.
Brendan in Nanaimo texts in, Petey and his line didn't produce. I don't think there's a need to look any more into it. That was the main reason the Canucks didn't generate enough offense.
It's a big part of it.
Pettersson needed to be way better.
No question.
100%. Pettersson needed to be way, way, way better. And we are going to spend an awful lot of time talking about Elias Pettersson and how it looks different, what needs to happen, what needs to change for him going forward to avoid the kind of months-long letdown that he had to end the Canucks season. That's also not the extent of it. Big factor? Yes, 100%, a huge factor. But I disagree. Where I disagree is that the conversation ends there, right? I guess there's two things I disagree with on the Pettersson conversation. One, that he's the scapegoat and all of the team's struggles offensively can be laid at his feet. I don't disagree. I don't agree with that.
No, nope.
A lot of them can, but there's plenty of blame to go around.
Hey, if Pettersson was in the form that he was the first 55 games of the year, that would have been
very different.
This whole playoff run looks very different.
Mm-hmm. So
no
that's
question.
Absolutely true, even though it's not, you can't just put it all on him and, you know, dust your hands off and call it a day in terms of your analysis. And then the other place where I obviously disagree. And
love to dust
this,
my hands off.
So what a satisfying feeling.
It's such a good motion. Like, I just think it's a good one.
The other place where I disagree with it is that this proved something definitive about Pettersson's lack of heart or his lack of suitability for the playoffs, or, you know, this team's not going to win with him. It's an 8-year albatross contract, yada, yada, yada. All of those takes, those very like emotional reactive takes to a really disappointing playoff loss, I think are kind of ridiculous. Place a ton of blame for how he performed in these playoffs at his feet, for the team losing, for the team not scoring enough. Yes, totally fair. Pretending like you know for a certainty that it will always be like that, right? That you're going to see that same movie replay over and over again in the future if he's on the team. I just think that's going way, way, way too far after really the player's first real playoff run in the Stanley Cup.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't good enough, but we don't have the full story yet. And so I'm just reserving judgment till we have the full story. You know, I look at Pettersson's season and I see 72 points in his first 55 games and I see 26 the rest of the way. And to me, that's a big tell. Not that a guy like got the yips in a big moment of the season, but that a guy might have worn down, that there might be more there. And so until I understand that, I'm not going to rigorously carve the guy, especially when what I'm seeing, the lack of power on his shot, in particular, the lack of strength protecting the puck down low, translating to an inability to get off the perimeter and inside the way he's done for 340 of his 400 career NHL games. You know, I'm not throwing years of watching Pettersson and knowing what his game looks like out the window because of a 30-game sample in which he massively struggled and didn't look like himself, like qualitatively.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, until I know more, I'm just sort of kind of reserving judgment and waiting. I think, though, that if he was playing hurt, one question that the organization and he should ask himself is, okay, if I'm going to be playing late into the spring every year, I'm going to have some games where I'm playing hurt. Do I have to do some things differently in terms of designing my game to still be effective at 80%, at 75%, at Dreisaitl level, where you know, Dreisaitl's a horse. Dreisaitl was massively dinged up in this series. We know that. And shift after shift, he was an absolute monster, right? There's other Canucks players who were playing hurt that we didn't notice, right?
Not in the same way.
And
yep.
And so that would sort of be the question for me is, I assume that there's something there. We'll eventually find out what it was. When we do, I think the question is, Is there sort of a need to design a game, like, or make changes within your game, just as a growth thing as an NHL player, where you can still make the difference offensively, even if you're not at 100%. That to me is sort of where the discussion is most interesting, as opposed to the classic Canadian market, like, he can't bring it in the playoffs. Like, I promise you, that's not it. I promise you, you will look silly a year or two from now if this team's back in this spot and Pettersson's fully healthy.
And I think that, you know, what you're describing, that process of taking this experience, taking this information and figuring out, okay, how to make it different in the future, that's where the rubber kind of hits the road in terms of like playoff experience being a real thing, right? Not just something intangible like, well, this guy has 40 career NHL playoff games, so he's going to do better than this guy with 10 NHL playoff games in his career. But the actual experience of physically, okay, this is how I'm going to feel at this time of year. I'm not used to that because I haven't been in this position before. Now what do I do to A, either not feel like that or feel better at this time of year, right? Prevent myself from being run down, from running out of gas by the time the playoffs roll around while still having a really productive, effective regular season. Or two, as you said, adjust your game so that even if you're not physically 100%, You're still able to be way, way more effective than what we saw from Elias Pettersson in this playoff run, because it was obviously just nowhere close to good enough. And so that's Pettersson's challenge as a player now, right, is figure out how to prevent this from happening. And I would bet on him doing that. He has figured out every challenge so far in his NHL career. So I have no reason whatsoever to think that he's not going to figure out how to rise to this particular challenge. Now, the team has to, he has to help the team get back here, right? He has to help put the team in more situations where he can prove that he's learned from it, where he can prove that he's made himself a more effective playoff player. But that's the conversation much more than, as you said, the, you know, oh, he needs a heart transplant, yada, yada, yada kind of thing, which I think is just so, so, so early and premature when it comes to Elias Pettersson. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So many thoughts coming in here on the day after the Canucks season ends with a Game 7 loss to the Edmonton Oilers last night at Rogers Arena. We got lots more to come. Still 2 more hours on the show. Allison Lucan will join us at 12:30. Dan Murphy from Sportsnet will join us at 1:30. And by the way, this will be our last official 3-hour show. We're back to the normal noon to 2 starting tomorrow. We'll have Donnie and Dolly for the crossover, Jason Buchla on Wednesday. So back to the normal schedule, but you know we had to do the 3-hour blowout show post-mortem here after the Canucks season ended last night. And we'll take a look back at the season. I want to talk about some of the biggest storylines that we'll remember from this Canucks season going forward. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of 5-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. So, okay, we're going to have a ton of time to get into the questions going forward into the summer. Who do they keep? Who do they target? What are the biggest challenges, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we might even start that today on the show. But certainly this week, you know, post-media availabilities, which, by the way, will be on Thursday. You obviously will hear everyone speaking on the live here on Sportsnet 650. Don't know the exact time, but of course we'll have you covered.
It'll probably be during our show.
And
we'll probably...
So as much as I'm like, I'm only coming in at noon now, I'm probably going to come in at 11. And you don't have to. You'll be there, but I'll come in at 11
And I'll probably run up to the booth afterwards and discuss takeaways or whatever.
Exactly.
We'll figure it out.
So probably during our show on Thursday. But before we dive headfirst into, okay, what happens next? What do they do? What are the challenges, et cetera? I do think it's worth looking back a little bit, not just at Game 7 last night, not just at the series with the Oilers or even the playoffs, but really the season in totality, because this is our opportunity to do it right now. Today is the day to do it. And what I was thinking is I wanted to just reflect on some of, like, maybe the top five biggest storylines from this season. Now, we can go back and forth. We can tier it. We can try to build a consensus list. How do you want to play this?
Why don't we go back and forth and make 10 nominees?
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? So we each nominate
nominate the same thing.
Correct. Okay. And then we will work together
to build a consensus
through the power
list.
Of friendship to build a consensus list. How about that?
I love it.
Is that a good process?
Beautiful.
Truly, let's go.
Truly beautiful collaboration on display here on Canucks Talk.
Well, it's a day to feel good, I think.
I think it's a day to be clear-eyed. Is how I would put it.
Well, every day is a day to be clear-eyed on Canucks Talk.
So true. Full hearts, not as much, but yeah. Clear eyed, yes.
Clear eyes, cold black hearts, can't lose.
Okay, so I'll start first nominee, and it's pretty easy for me, what should be in the number one spot. It's Rick Tocchet. Rick Tocchet's season as coach, Rick Tocchet's effect on the team, the success, Rick Tocchet's ability to communicate with the fan base and the effect that's had on the fan base. I think just in general, the Rick Tocchet experience, when I look back on this season, that is what will stand out first and foremost to me. So I think that's got to be number one.
Okay. I'm labeling it as the Rick Tocchet experience.
Yep. I love it.
I'm going to go with Quinn Hughes.
Okay.
Becomes best defenseman on planet Earth.
That's good. Yep. That was on my list as well. Quinn Hughes Norris campaign. That's a huge one.
Well, he's going to win it.
Mm-hmm.
And he should win it. I loved Kevin BX's commentary on Spitting Chicklets, by the way, about how Quinn Hughes should have gotten more consideration for Hart. The problem is the Hart. The contestants for the MVP this year were so
unworldly,
ludicrous that it kind of squeezed Quinn Hughes out. I feel like in a normal year, he would have had a stronger case. But spoiler alert, I had him on my ballot.
Ooh.
Anyway, Quinn Hughes,
so
best
Quinn
defenseman
Hughes,
on the planet.
I think that's a good one. The next one up for me would be the revitalization of the fan base and the kind of reestablishment of the connection between the fan base and the team, the excitement, and then that really peaked in the playoffs.
Yep.
And with the way the players talked about the experience, the way Rick Tocchet talked about it, whether you were at the games, whether you were just watching on TV, you saw it around town, you know what it meant. That has to be a huge part of the season-long storyline for me.
The Tyler Myers commentary, right, where... So, because think about Tyler Myers' career, right? Like, Tyler Myers has been around a long time. He's 34 now, right? He has played, like, he was on the last team that made the playoffs in Buffalo. That's a pretty crazy sports market.
That is actually wild.
What?
That he was on the last team. He hasn't been in Buffalo for a long time,
since 2015.
Oh, man.
I know.
Buffalo.
Sucks. And then he was on those Jets teams, so... Those Jets teams, remember,
went to the conference finals with the Jets, right?
Went to the conference final with the Jets against the expansion Vegas Golden Knights.
Yep.
Right? They beat Nashville the prior round when Nashville was like at its peak crazy fandom, right? Mm-hmm. It was the year
after they went to the finals.
After they went to the finals.
Yeah.
So like peak nuts Predators hockey. Not to mention the Winnipeg whiteout, right? And yesterday pregame, he's like, ever since that first game, I got chills, and I've been telling my family, you've got to get out here and come to the game. He obviously got Quentin Grimes out there to the game.
Mm-hmm.
His half-brother, of course, who plays for the Detroit Pistons. And he was like, and it was just, again, that low guttural where you know a guy's serious. He's like, because it's different. That was the comment. And sometimes it's the stuff that you don't sell that means the most.
Right.
You know, it's like,
because he wasn't gilding the lily and like really lathering it on. He was just like, no, it's different.
It's different here.
Yeah.
That to me is more powerful than if he'd like been trying to give a marketing soundbite. It's different. Yeah. It's different.
It was different. It was different relative to previous Canucks playoff appearances, right? Like, it was different relative to the league. It was different relative to the history in the city.
Yeah.
And that's a testament to the fans, but it's also a testament to Tocchet, the players, et cetera, and the work they put in. So that's number two for me.
I'm going to go with the Rutherford era high volume trading experience. Because that was something that we saw all season, right? Like, The day training camp opens, the club acquires Casey DeSmith, sends out Tanner Pearson, on and on. Sam Lafferty ahead of, you know, the roster compliance day, right before waivers kick in. Zadorov, right? Then jumping the market on Lindholm. And you sort of get
then,
to this.
Then the reports that they were might flip Lindholm.
Right.
that was a wild one.
And us knowing that we had to take those seriously, right?
Yeah.
It was, you know, in a season where very few in-season trades happened at all, the Canucks were like out there tweaking sort of relentlessly. And I think ultimately achieving a competitive advantage over the course of those moves, like with the volume of those moves accumulating and those improvements sort of massively helping the team. So for me, that would be up there. The Rutherford era high volume trading experience.
Would you have that distinct from the like pro scouting heater role player acquisition?
I would, because I thought we were talking in season.
Oh, okay, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I like that. All right. So we'll because the management team had to be represented somehow in this.
Yeah.
So I like that as a that kind of constant churn, constant looking for that next acquisition.
I also think the pro scouting heater, I wouldn't say it receded by any means, but you come through the playoffs and you do have a slightly different perspective on it,
sure.
Don't you? I mean, is Hronek still a home run?
Yep, that's a totally fair question.
You know, I think it is, right? Is Lafferty a home run?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
Smith?
This team picks in the third round, the fourth round, the sixth round, twice in the seventh round in this draft. And we just talked about all the significant offensive needs. A fifth round pick, probably nothing. But Sam Lafferty in this playoffs, also nothing. You know, like, so I don't know.
That's fair.
I think it extends beyond that too. Lindholm had a beastly playoffs. He was so good away from the puck, but he didn't help this team drive play. You know, like, he didn't solve sort of the issue that we kept talking about all season, which was how do you get this top six to control play better? You know, so Casey DeSmith ultimately isn't their guy in the playoffs.
Yep, I think that's a fair debate.
Mikheyev now looking like a bad contract. So in some ways, this club definitely had a pro scouting heater, and I think the work filling in with glue guys, I mean, there's still more hits than misses. Dakota Joshua, Nikita Zadorov, you know, I still think you can put Lindholm in the makes. I just think it's a little more complicated than that.
Yep.
Teddy Bluger, even though he only had 2 points in the playoffs and sort of struggled when elevated to the third line, you know, a lot of wins.
Suter. Oh, we haven't even mentioned Pugh Suter.
A huge win, but also 3 points in the playoffs, uh-huh, despite spending the whole year on the top line. Or the whole run on the top line.
That's, to me, that's not because they did a... That doesn't take it away from being a pro scouting success. You needed to also pro scout a legitimate top line winger, so he wasn't there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, and Kuzmenko not working
with
Tocket.
It's not like a poor evaluation on Suter.
Yeah, and Kuzmenko not working with Tocket, too.
Yep.
So, I'm just saying, the pro scouting heater, it's still true, but I do think it's... There was like a giddiness to parts of this Canucks season that I do think in the sober light of day today, you know, I at least think are shaded with a little more gray than the discussion around this team reflected for much of the year. Anyway.
Okay, that's fair. So we have Tocket, revitalizing the fan base, Hughes, the trades in season. We got to talk about just Elias Pettersson. And this is not solely or maybe even mostly a positive, but from the performance early in the year to the drop off, the contract discourse, which took up so much time in January and February, and then the reaction, the performance, the lack of production into the playoffs, and the conversation around him in the market. Just like, no matter how you slice it, no matter how you come down on the player, what your opinion on the contract is, one of the absolute biggest stories of this season for the Canucks.
I'm going to label this one Elias Pettersson. Success, certainty, and disappointment.
Yeah.
Man, there was a lot.
There was a lot of Elias Pettersson stuff this year.
This is going to be number one.
The boat.
This is going to be number one. When we put this together at the end of the day, because Pettersson's success and the way that his future hung over this team, hung over this retooling experiment, mm-hmm, even as it was wildly successful, the fact that, you know, getting Pettersson done when they did in a lot of ways justified the price paid for win now success, which, you know, the team won now 50 games, second round, but also didn't get to the conference final, you know, with a draft class plus worth of picks invested on upgrading this team. And then having agreed to that contract, Pettersson disappoints to such an extent that he'll enter next season with people wondering if he's worth the extension. He is. It's not actually a significant concern or question, but the fact that the club had certainty seemed like such a win when it happened and then became something of a quandary, something that people feel uneasy about going into the summer, given how the season ended for him. I mean, what a wild campaign for this young man.
Oh, absolutely. And again, for like the Quinn Hughes leveling up one is just kind of a pure, we're going to hear, I'm sure, some injury stuff from Quinn Hughes, right, that colors his playoff performance a little differently. But like, that is just an overwhelmingly positive
maybe
story.
I would say during that Nashville series, I thought it was going to be a major storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there's some guys you suspect are hurt or just assume are hurt, and then you hear that it's maybe not as bad as you think. I'm not saying that's Quinn Hughes, but I'm not sure about that one.
But anyways, my point is the Quinn Hughes story, overwhelmingly positive. The Patterson one, just very multifaceted. Let's put it that way. All
no
right.
Question.
What's your next nomination?
I'm going to go with Thatcher Demko's late season injury.
Okay.
Just because, for me anyway, tracking this, the uncertain timelines, the fact that he made it back and then got hurt again, just that gut punch. Like, I mean, you were on the radio live when we learned it. I mean, it was like a therapy session for Canucks fans. You know, Demko is such a crucial part of this team. He's a Vezina nominee goaltender. He was having this unbelievable year. It sort of stopped short and then stopped short again. And then he seemed to be on the verge, like, to the point where as Woodley talked to us about yesterday, like, the exercises that he was doing were so advanced, and I can tell you this because I sit next to Woodley, until Seelovs led the team on the ice, Woodley was like, I'm not sure it's not Demko. Like, that's how close it seemed like Demko was at the end there. To me, that's just something that I really feel like it colored the entire experience of this Canucks playoff run, even to the point that, I do think one of the reasons why, despite falling short against Edmonton last night, one of the reasons that fans are still like, what a gutsy effort, is that this team did it mostly with their third string netminder.
Demko, yeah.
You know, I think that's like huge context for why this season feels more like a snow day, despite, you know, falling short, as opposed to, you know, something maybe a little more urgent than that. So for me, Thatcher Demko's late season injury belongs on this.
And that's one that has huge implications going forward as well, right? Managing Thatcher Demko's health in the next season, but also the emergence of Artur Shelov in the playoffs and what that means for how the team handles their goaltending position next year.
And especially because he's waiver exempt, right? Like, this team needed all three goalies, right? They turned to a backup in Casey DeSmith, who gave them a career defining game three performance. And then had a minor injury. They turned to Shelovs and he never gave up the crease. They needed all three guys this year. I'm sorry. There's no question. And if Shelovs is an NHL level guy who's waiver exempt, we'll talk about this. But I remain convinced that it would be an error to go into the season with Shelovs as your backup. I think you have to go in, especially if you have designs on something bigger. You have this opportunity to have a guy you know is a bona fide NHL-level goaltender who's waiver-exempt. You cannot waste that opportunity, especially given the ages of Miller, Pettersson, Hughes, the level that they all hit, and the fact that, you know, Besser's expiring after next season, and you've got this OEL buyout that becomes actually prohibitive beyond next year. You know, like, next year is a year to have extra goalie depth. There's ways of structure, and I'll save this take because I think it's an important one.
Okay, I'm going to group a bunch of guys together here and go with the, like, scoring winger reversal. So Brock Besser, who had previously, his agent had permission to seek a trade, scores 40 goals, incredible playoff performance until he's very unfortunately forced out of the lineup with blood clots. Connor Garland, beginning of the season, hey, if you guys want to trade me, my agent will help. I'm down for that. Incredible season. Fans are chanting his name. Huge offensive driver. Earns Rick Tocchet's trust. Top six guy in terms of minutes in the playoffs. And then the flip side of that is Andre Kuzmenko, right? From 39 goals to healthy scratch to this guy's not going to get minutes down the stretch. This guy can't be trusted. And he's shipped out of town. And I think just in total, kind of the dramatic turnaround. I don't want to minimize the individual. Like, I could have just said Brock Besser, right? 40 goal season, bounce back, obviously. But I do think, kind of looking in total, just at guys who looked like they were on the way out, looked like they were serious distressed assets, who found their identity, found a place, found a way to contribute. And then the flip side of that, Andre Kuzmenko, who looked like, is he a core player, right? Like, is he, or if he's not a true core player, he's like the next tier to being a guy that they decided couldn't help him win.
Nobody saw it coming.
I didn't say it was unpredictable. I didn't say it was shocking. It's just a big story.
I'm sorry. I just,
you know, wear yourself out there, buddy.
I don't want to bruise my back too early in the offseason.
You got lots of time for that.
I just want to go with the, I'm just trying to think of how broadly I should draw this one. I'm going to go with, I'll save that one. I'm going to go with the PDO machine goes burr. Okay?
It's a good one.
the first few months of this season where everything was going the Canucks' way, right? Like, just like that game in Seattle where they had like three unscreened wrist shot goals, you know, off of the rush, right? And just like all of this offense that like there were moments. Remember early in the season, the Canucks were like 1-2-3 in NHL scoring. It was Hughes, Miller.
Yep.
And Pettersson. And Pettersson. And Besser was number one in goals.
Leading the, yep.
And it was like you were playing on NHL franchise mode. You know what I mean? And like you were like 2 months into the season, and you're like, killing all these bum teams on easy. Like that's how it felt for months of this Canucks season. You know, Sam Lafferty had like 10 goals by Christmas. Ilya Mikheyev
was producing.
Ilya Mikheyev was a top five-on-five goal scorer in the league,
yep,
after missing several games toward the tail end of his recovery from ACL surgery last summer, and like he was shot out of a cannon to open this season. And then over the second half, we saw that offense become mid, right? More like average, finished the year seventh in goals, and then scored 13 goals across six games against the Nashville Predators, one of them into an empty net, and then chased Stuart Skinner with an incredible run through the first three games of the series, and then up 2-1 in this series, right? The Edmonton Oilers needing to win 3 of 4 to advance, mm-hmm, right? The Canucks scored 8 goals the rest of the way, right? I just think this team's experience with the way they played offense, the way that they were talked about, how that was influenced by the PDO thing, the way fans leaned into it and made it a joke, the way analysts leaned into it and made it a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt like that was a big part of the Canucks experience this season.
I think that's a good shout, that it was part of what we'll look back on and remember, yeah, like the jokes, all of it, the discussion, the debate, the discourse, the PDO discourse, 100%. Okay, I think we got to bring up JT Miller. And
yes,
part of this is his performance on the ice, another monster campaign in terms of production, his elevation as a two-way center,
yeah,
huge for this team. And then also just the way, and so many of these things are related, right? But like how different he's viewed by the fan base now, I think, than
that's,
he was
that's the
18
biggest,
months ago.
For me, that's the biggest. The ability to level up as a defensive center at the age of 30 is amazing. But, you know, the way he's introduced and then the fans, you know, JT, yep, and then the fans shout the Miller, the callback, like, When he first signed that extension, I remember thinking to myself, like, man, that's a big investment to make on a guy whose jersey I don't see very often around town.
Mm-hmm.
And then it did kind of flip. It was starting to flip. You heard, you know, during that Bruce There It Is campaign anyway, like right before he signed that extension, you'd walk by schools and hear people be like, I'm JT Miller, like little kids playing hockey and stuff like that started to be a thing. But the way that the relationship between that player and this fan base now, it's like it feels a little Todd Bertuzzi before the drama.
Yeah.
You know, where it was like the there's like a level of toughness in his game, the power forward thing, the emotion, mm-hmm, the passion that he plays with that I think really resonates with fans in this market. And to me, it really does feel like Bertuzzi-esque, but Bertuzzi adjacent prior to obviously the Moore and everything that came there, like the height of Bertuzzi, that sort of feels like the level of, like, you know, it's not even cult hero. It's just like fan favorite status
like
that Miller has attained.
It's when like a star offensive player also has like role player attributes. You know what I mean? And it's like similar thing with Todd Bertuzzi, where it's like the toughness and the emotion and the physicality. It's like those are often things we think of as like, hey, this plucky third line player who earns a spot in the fans' hearts. But it's like, but then you're also scoring 40 goals and putting up, you know, 90 plus points. It's like, oh, okay, now you really take it to another level, right? And I think that's a big part of the story,
yeah,
with JT Miller.
Well, and people always bring up the Kessler comp, and I've never seen it, but I like the Bertuzzi comp.
It's a good one. I like that. Okay, you have one more. We're gonna have to do a. Well, we're running out of time.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll just really quickly throw in club levels up defensively to like at historic rate.
Yeah.
You know, I just think the way that this team was able to play defense, the fact that it was such a massive, like it was a bleep show to watch this team try to defend, mm-hmm, or play without the puck as recently as, you know, 18 months ago. And now, you know, from the blue line in, even last night, they were really, really strong. I mean, the penalty killing, you know, really giving even the Oilers power play, mm-hmm, problems in this playoff series. Like, what? This team? Are you kidding me? That's an unbelievable improvement. Okay, now let's quickly sort these and then move on.
So I know you said Pettersson. I do want to give a shout to Tocchet as the number one story.
No way.
Man, I just think, because it's how
coaches come and go. Pettersson's here for 8 years.
But so much of the other stuff we're talking about also relates to Tocchet, right? Like the defensive improvement.
It's a players' league,
man. Revitalizing the fan base, all of that.
I get what you're saying. I appreciate it. But it's a players' league. Like, when we look back on these seasons, we're going to look back on them in the context of what they mean mostly for the players. For Hughes, for Pettersson, for like the best defenseman in franchise history, for maybe the best centerman in franchise history, for maybe a dark horse contender to get into the discussion for best center in franchise history in JT Miller. Like, we're going to look at it through that lens, and Pettersson had the most going on around him this season in terms of the contract, the most long-reaching implications. For me, there's no discussion.
And I'll say
Petey.
The thing with Pettersson that makes me fine tipping over here is...
Yeah, sorry.
No, I don't care.
I wasn't going to concede.
Is... it feels like the start of a story one way or another for Elias Pettersson.
That's exactly it.
Right? Like, yep. So either way, no matter which direction it goes, we'll look back on everything that happened this year and the conversation this year around
100%
Elias Pettersson. But I think Tocchet has to be number two.
I'll concede to Rick Tocchet number two.
Okay. Three, I do think the revitalizing the fan base. If we're talking big picture thing here, like, maybe not three, but I think it's got to be in the top five.
I agree with you, but I think three should be Demko's late season injury.
Okay.
Just because I think it's such a... It had such an impact on this team's playoff run and the psyche and the way it was experienced, you know, and I think it's got massive implications for like what they do this summer, how Demko's discussed in this market, what his future looks like. So, you know, I think there's an awful lot that goes into that. I think Quinn Hughes becomes the best defenseman on planet Earth, maybe goes ahead of Demko, though.
Okay, for number three?
Well, like, he's going to win the Norris probably, and that's going to be the first time that's ever happened for a Canucks defenseman.
Yeah.
This franchise, like...
First time taking home a major trophy, that's got to be pretty high.
Yeah, so I think Quinn Hughes 3,
Demko 4,
and then the fan experience 5.
Fan experience 5.
Okay. You cool with that?
I like that. So we got Pettersson, Tocchet, Hughes, Demko, the fan experience.
Well, and really, it's revitalizing the brand, right? Because it's not just about the passion that you saw in arena.
No.
It's also about, like, the confidence that Canucks fans feel going into this offseason in Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin. It's the fact that now when Francesco Aquilini tweets, people are like, that's actually funny.
Yeah, we like it.
It's like, oh, he retweeted one of his old bad tweets. This is good now. Like that's the power of what we're talking about, right? It's the public faith in a Canucks institution that as recently as 18 months ago looked deeply rotten from the outside.
All right. I think that's a good list. I think we did it. Good exercise. The top five storylines from this year for
We'll do that
the
again.
Canucks.
I like building consensus lists. That's good stuff. It's better than tears.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
High praise from Thomas Strand.
It works better on radio.
Better than tears.
Yeah.
Okay. We got to take a break. Alex
not as
Lucan,
good as drafting, better
not
than
as good
tears.
As drafting. It's tier two between drafting and tears.
Let's draft our favorite segments, and then we'll know.
Okay. Allison Lucan from Root Sports Northwest joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Strantz here. We are live from the Kintec studio. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and we will get back into the text box later on in the show. But as mentioned, now joining us from Root Sports Northwest, covering the Seattle Kraken, she is Allison Lucan. Allison, thank you as always. How are you today?
I'm good. How are we hanging in, guys? That's a rough, just abrupt stop to the end of a great season.
You know what? For a Game 7 loss to a Western Canadian rival, I'm not going to say it's all you know, sunshine and rainbows up here and unicorns, but a lot more positivity than I think you would typically expect in that situation, which I think just reflects where the expectations were for this team. But a lot of disappointment, I'm not going to deny that, but you know what? We're hearing a lot of positivity from our fans as well, and you saw that at the end of the game, right? Saluting the team after the series was over. What did you think of Game 7? Did you think the Canucks had another miracle comeback in them there at the end?
Well, you know, to be honest, I didn't until that final, what was it, 8 minute stretch.
Yep.
They just looked out of gas, you know, and every team ultimately has to go through all kinds of challenges. But, you know, I think of all those miles this team logged going back and forth to Nashville. Then they're logging miles going back and forth to Edmonton. They obviously lose their goaltender. They obviously lose Brock Besser. And it just seemed like they were a step behind. I was really impressed that they found that press at the end. And to your point, I thought that the home crowd was just outstanding. Kudos to all those fans in the building. That was really, really special. You would have hoped for maybe a little bit more of a press through all 60, but I give the team credit for coming back towards the end like they did.
Allison, can you think of a recent example of like a really good, disciplined, structural defensive team that shoots efficiently and makes it to Game 7 of the second round, but maybe doesn't follow it up the next year?
I could only imagine.
Maybe they play in the Pacific Northwest, Allison.
It's funny. The similarities are there for sure.
Do you see those similarities? What do you think the Canucks' chances of maintaining the form that they hit this season are as we sort of go into an off season of uncertainty? Obviously this will be a far fairer question to ask you in September, but just given your proximity to a very similar situation that the Kraken sort of found themselves in over the last 12 months, I figured I'd get your initial thoughts.
No, absolutely. You've got two groups that found great success. You know, a lot of people will dismiss it to be purely a PDO bender, but I think that people who followed, you know, the Canucks this year or the Kraken last year know that that's far too simplistic of an explanation. But I do see similarities, and I think there are some lessons waiting to see if this Canucks group learns them. Again, I'm by no means saying that these are two of the exact same teams. There's so many intricacies that are different, but it's going to be crucial to look at a few key things, in my opinion. The first and the hardest to control is going to be injuries, right? Both teams, in their regular season in particular, had great stretches of great health on their roster, which let them continue to have the success that they had. So obviously you need that magic ingredient. And then you need to come back with the mindset knowing that the next year isn't going to be as easy. The pucks are probably not going to fall as easily as they did. And I think those first two elements really did bite the Kraken in the behind. Dave Hakstol told us in his exit interviews, as did Ron Francis, that the message to the players after last season was don't come back thinking it's going to be this easy as it was this year. And I think that mindset, those lessons learned about attitude and preparedness and work ethic have to be just really ground in from the puck drop game one. And then the final piece is going to be roster construction. I mean, you guys know the Canucks are going to have some pieces to move around, some new faces probably coming on, some faces departing. The Kraken had the same. And so how does that affect what this team can do? But I think, you know, I'm giving a lot of cautionary tales, and I think those are important. But I think that one can also really retain a sense of optimism because a lot of these foundational pieces for the Canucks look really, really promising to me from behind the bench up and through the roster.
100%. The one analogy, though, Allison, that kind of spooks me almost a little bit is, in particular, the Kraken, in my view, lost a lot of like secondary scoring that was also attached to size, with like with like Geeky and Sprong moving on, and then replaced it with Yamamoto, who wasn't as productive and obviously didn't have that same size component. And then on the back end, just a downgrade from Soucy to Dumoulin.
Dumoulin.
And that ultimately hurt a little bit. And I sort of think about this Canucks team and who they've got expiring, right? Myers, Zadorov, and Dakota Joshua. That's like, you know, 6'6" on average of expiring guys, right, with size. Joshua sort of a crucial secondary scoring threat. When you think about, you know, the likes of Hronek, Joshua, Myers, all of the defensemen that the Canucks have expiring right now. What should this team prioritize? Big picture, like, what does this team need more of? Big picture, not specific players, but like that extra element in your view to sort of get over the hump in the playoffs in the Pacific Division.
Yeah, I think who they keep around and who they maybe don't is going to be the crucial decision. You know, obviously the two deadline around that time frame acquisitions, you know, those are going to be big pieces to ask questions about. I thought Zadorov was excellent for the Canucks coming over. I think, you know, I did a very simplistic analysis at the start of the Kraken season, just looking, and I'm sure that Ron Francis's team did something much deeper. And again, even if you had approximated the Kraken staying 80% healthy as they did the previous season, even with the roster replacements based on a 3 to 5 year production average for those players, the Kraken would have come out with the same number of goals this past season as two ago. But Vince Dunn is gone for 30 plus games of the season. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not just the efficacy of the pieces that you do or do not keep. It's what's happening around them. And, you know, again, the reason the Kraken worked was it was those waves of depth. And so you take out any core pieces of those waves, and the whole system started to come onto a really shaky foundation.
Yeah, and for the Canucks going forward, I mean, just from your perspective, and, you know, drawing on covering the Kraken, but also just in general around the league, is the challenge kind of to, as you say, kind of internalize what you did well and, okay, recognize what are the things we can continue while also just being really, really disciplined about what's out of your control, right? Like, whether it's health, whether it's some players just pricing themselves out of your ability to pay them. But, like, it strikes me as that's something very difficult, to just be very, very disciplined and clear-eyed about what we can control from this great season going forward and what's kind of out of our control and what can we do to address those and shore them up.
Yeah, and, you know, I think for sure a lot of those answers are going to come. You guys have exits on Thursday, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is going to be, what do we hear there? You know, was Quinn Hughes dealing with something? He didn't look his full self to me, you know, from about midway through that Nashville series on. You know, what's going on? I know this story has been beaten to death, but what's going on with Pettersson? Mm-hmm. You know, are there other players who were dinged up or who were not? What do we think we can expect with Brock Besser? Once I think you have some of those answers, then I think you start to look at how close is this window? And I think that is going to drive the decisions, because this season is great and it's awesome. And I love seeing hockey be such a great, exciting thing in Vancouver again. But we all know next year, if it's not the same plus, now that disappointment starts to creep in. So you've got to build to the window at the right time in the right way.
You know, and on Elias Pettersson, as you said, that has been, trust me, a subject of a lot of discussion. I mean, we were kind of going through, like, biggest stories looking back from the Canucks season that we'll remember. And we had the Elias Pettersson, all of it, experience, the contract, the debate, as kind of the number one story from this Canucks season. How do you think fans and analysts and people even inside the NHL should react to a superstar player of Pettersson's age with his track record of production having a very lackluster playoff performance, right? And as you said, look, injury information might color how we look at this, but just in general, like, it's so difficult to not give in to kind of the emotional reaction of, like, oh, he choked, he came up short. But you also have to acknowledge that, yeah, he didn't do enough. How should we kind of look at this in the totality of Pettersson's career?
Yeah, you know, again, we talk about that a lot of times with the playoffs. You take all of the stats and all of the true predictive things that we know in hockey and kind of throw it out the window, because it's maybe 7 games at most and you're not really getting a true sample size. For me, I want to look at, and again, there were some concerns there towards the end of the regular season for him, but I want to look at what he's been doing in the totality of his career thus far. Understand, again, were there injuries? Understand the pressure that this team was under for the first time with some significant expectations, basically from a season that people didn't know if they were even going to be sniffing the postseason, to doing what they did and being right outside the top 5 in the league in terms of total points. So I want to understand where his mindset is. Look at his regular season. To me right now, I don't think we're anywhere near a situation where we're having question marks like a Pierre-Luc Dubois or someone like that. But I think we need to understand where this player is and perhaps whether it's skill and mental training help this player get access to the tools that help him take the next step. Because we talk about the skill development on ice so much, but I think you talk about taking the next step onto the bigger stage and the bigger stage and the bigger stage. And we have to make sure that these uber talented players always have the tools they need to be the best that they can in that part of their game as well.
It's been a little bit since Dave Hackstall was dismissed in Seattle. Just to sort of turn the conversation back to the Kraken a little bit, because I'm curious to get your sense of what is the organization looking for in terms of its next leader, its next bench boss? What are sort of the priorities that you're hearing about being weighted heavily there?
Yeah, and of course, you know, again, Ron Francis is rightly one of the most protective front office executives in the league right now. So I'm not hearing much from him. But, you know, I think that what we heard was the biggest issue being consistency. And that obviously runs up and down the roster and the coaching staff. But I think you're looking for someone who maybe, you know, we talked about how the Kraken faced some different kinds of adversity this season after that beautiful, exciting run last year. And so is there someone who is best equipped to deal with the curveballs and to deal with a roster that is going to be growing and evolving as the Kraken still build to be what is going to be their legitimate contention window, but also balance the veteran presence? And I'm by no means saying that Dave Hackstall could not do that, but I think those are some of the priorities that might be on Ron Francis's desk.
So we have the final four set now in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Obviously, Dallas and Edmonton here in the West, the Rangers and the Panthers out East. Just kind of broadly looking at these two series, what has you excited to watch? What are some of your big questions going into the conference finals?
Yeah, obviously, you know, we're all a little, I always enjoy saying we're West Coast biased out here since there's so much East Coast bias in the NHL, but it is the Western matchup that has a little bit more of my attention. You know, I mean, you guys know I had the Canucks picked in seven.
Yep.
It's only the second series I've gotten wrong so far, and they were close. But I do want to see Edmonton stack up against Dallas. My argument for Vancouver being able to take this over Edmonton had been a little bit more balanced. I think a lot of what happened, particularly in these last two games, was self-inflicted at times by the Canucks. And so I'd like to see if the balance of Dallas, particularly, it sounds like Roope Hintz is going to be able to play. How can Edmonton tackle that kind of balance and strength all over the roster? And then it's the easy answer, but I do want to see the battle of the goaltenders in the East. I think those two teams are so unique that it's probably going to come down to which one of those two is going to have the exemplary series.
Allison, can I give you the weirdest take I've ever had from a personal standpoint? I'm looking at the Eastern Conference Final. Okay, I'm looking at the Eastern Conference Final, and I'll be honest with you, I can't help but think. I feel like unclean as I'm about to say this. I don't know that the Panthers have a really good answer for Matthew Rempe, and I think it's going to be a problem. Like, did you hear he was asked about Matthew Tkachuk, and he was like, "Oh, I have a bone to pick with him because I'm from Calgary and he left Calgary." And I was like, "Oh, that's terrifying. You're a scary human being."
I go back and forth on Rempe. I'm certainly not one that says absolutely no fighting ever, but obviously, when this kid comes into the league, you know, you heard people who were experienced in that skill saying he doesn't know how to defend himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't care for at the start of his NHL career that his story was becoming the fighting versus what does this player do on the ice. And this time of year in this league as it is now, it can't be just about that. Now, if he can continue to have the balance that he seems to be finding in his game, I don't know that I disagree with you. Even if, you know, you go back to the Boston series, there was some physicality, but not a dominance on either side, in my opinion. So I'm willing to buy into that theory. We'll have to see how crazy it is in a week or so.
Allison, really appreciate the time as always. And yeah, we're doing all right up here. The Canucks fans are doing all right. I think they're mostly keeping this season in perspective, and look forward to chatting more as the Stanley Cup playoffs continue.
Well, absolutely. Congrats to you and all the fans. You had a great run, and hopefully here's to more success next season.
Hey, next year, let's get the Kraken and the Canucks good in the same season. It's going to happen.
Easy travel. Let's go.
Yeah, give me that I-5 playoff series. That would be amazing.
That would be fantastic. Thank you, Allison.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
That is Allison Lucan covering the Seattle Kraken for Root Sports Northwest, and a regular on our show here throughout the Stanley Cup playoffs. Yeah, that would be fantastic, man.
That's the dream.
Oh, one of these days. One of these days, it'll happen.
So much better than Nashville. I'm still so upset. Anyway, I'm serious about Matt Rempe. I think
I hadn't heard that Calgary line. That's very funny.
So funny. And it's terrifying.
I'm going to beat you up for the sake of my city. That's what's coming here.
Well, it's such a smart way to threaten a guy acceptably. You know what I mean? Like, you can't threaten anyone in the NHL explicitly, not after the Bertuzzi thing. But he found a way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like the Tom Wilson thing, where it's like, it's not just that they're terrifying and willing to be reckless.
It's the mind games.
It's that they're smart enough to do it, to find the line and exactly sit on it, right? I don't think there's another player in the league that is as intimidating right now as Rempe. And I'm just curious, like, do the Panthers have to insert Jonah Gadjevich into their lineup? I think they might.
But is that, like, all respect to Jonah Gadjevich, does that change the complexion of the series?
Well, it means that the Panthers don't have their 12 best forwards on the ice.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like, does that actually meaningfully address anything that Matt Rempe is going to do, or does it just make your team worse?
Well, because the one thing is, he's not going to see much ice time against Matthew Tkachuk, but I think he can wear down that defense in a meaningful way. He's not just a one-dimensional fighter,
Rempe,
right? He can skate.
Yeah, no, for sure. He can hit.
Yeah. I'm telling you.
But that's what I mean. So, okay, you bring in Jonah Gadjevich, but like, and then what does Matt Rempe, like, how does that stop Matt Rempe?
It doesn't.
So why are they going to do it?
Maybe they don't. In which case, I think it's going to be one of those things where Tkachuk might have to actually change his behavior, which might actually reduce their swagger, which might, I'm just saying. I'm looking at that series, and do you know how loath I would be to pick the Rangers over the Panthers?
I do.
Like, come on. It's really hard to find two teams that I've had, like, a wider... Everyone's been high on the Rangers for a while. Panthers, you know, I've been sort of higher than market. Like, and yet I'm looking at the series. I'm like, I think the Rangers can win this series, and I think Matt Rempe is a big X factor for why.
Amazing. Okay, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line here. And so we did our consensus list of... biggest stories for the Canucks season. And a couple of people texted in one that we didn't nominate, that we didn't have on the list. Matt from Surrey said, fall off of the power play this season has to be up there. Somebody else texting in, how about the power play? It doesn't rise to the level of some of the other stories that we were talking about from this season. I absolutely think as you're doing the post-mortem of where did things start to go wrong, where did they ultimately go wrong for the Canucks in the postseason, that, yeah, the power play has to be part of the story. But I just don't know that it's something we'll remember as clearly as we remember Quinn Hughes winning the Norris, as we remember Thatcher Demko's injury, the debate around Elias Pettersson's contract, et cetera, et cetera.
So one thing I do want to bring up, though, is, like, this core group, okay? So at the very least, Miller... Pettersson, Hughes.
Hold on. But just before, okay. Al in Calgary texted in, I hope Rempe doesn't come after me, but I think we all wish we could leave. That's from Al in Calgary. It's a good text, Al. Thank you for texting in. I had to interrupt you to get that in.
All good. Take your shots at Alberta today, Canucks fans. Where you can find them. Sorry, if you interrupt me these days, I lose my train of thought.
I knew it was dangerous.
I'm so tired, man.
We were this core group of players on the power play is where you were going.
Game 7 against Vegas in the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
They had a major penalty, and they didn't score. And then last night, they get the double minor, and they don't score. So one was under Newell Brown, one was under Rick Tocchet. Like, one thing that's happened, and I know we don't count the bubble the same way we count what happened last night, one thing that has now happened to this group twice is they've had huge power play opportunities with a chance to advance to the conference final.
In game sevens.
Extended looks. Mm-hmm. And failed to get even one by the goaltender. And honestly, on both, like, failed to even meaningfully pressure. That's tough.
It is. And again, to me, it's more of a playoff story than a season-long story, although obviously
Definitely a season-long story.
No, but like, in terms of how we'll remember it.
For sure.
You know what I mean? The roots of it, the roots of the struggle. It's not like it just started in the playoffs.
Well, where'd they end up for the playoffs? It was like 15.8% going into last night, so it might have been like 13%, given how small a sample we're talking about. I mean, it wasn't good enough. 13.9%. That's tough. By the way,
And it helped them win two games in the playoffs, you'd say. And then other than those two games, it was a non-factor.
And by the way, I talked about how playoff success is actually negatively correlated with power play success. Not true this year. Dallas Stars 29%, Edmonton Oilers 37.5%. Wowza. Florida Panthers 22%, New York Rangers 31.4%.
Wow.
So everyone's getting it done on the power play. If you're making the conference final, you're getting it done on the power play.
You're connecting. And, yeah, and we know Carolina's struggles on the power play, right? You go back to the first round, like Toronto's struggles on the power play.
Nashville, 9.1%. Like, yeah. You get power play goals. It's the new NHL, right? Like, leads are hard to hold.
Yeah.
Power play goals, power play opportunities come in game seven. If you can't get it done there, it's really tough. Rick talked a little bit last night about how one reason the Canucks kept being able to come back is that they were always able to prevent the fourth goal.
Mm.
They're defensive. But the opposite's true. One of the reasons they needed to come back is that they hadn't gotten the power play goal.
Yep.
You know, like, so that you're not coming back to force OT, you're coming back to win. So, you know, would we even be talking about Vancouver's offensive struggles as much as we are?
If the power play had clicked.
And the answer is no.
No, the answer is no. Now, the 5-on-5 struggles might have still been there. But yeah, the fact that they both
but the power play at least
let them
masked
down
it
at the same time 100%. Was a huge part of the story. Okay, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep your thoughts coming in. We'll take a break. Dan Murphy is going to join us in the final segment of the show. So we got another open segment up next. JanPro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact JanPro for a free, no obligation quote. Visit jampro.ca. More Canucks talk on the way here on Sportsnet 650.